I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Thank you so much, John, as ever. Thanks to everyone at the London Review Bookshop, of course, for making all these wonderful events possible in this extraordinary arc, this kind of refuge sanctuary, and also provocation to the larger culture outside about the state of things. And that state of things, of course, is something we're all too aware of, which is why tonight's event makes us even more delighted than it normally would. I should say that, of course, the gift of this building starts in the toilet, this major toilet action on the literature front, just as a random selection of leaflets taken from the facilities a minute or so ago reveal the UK's only dedicated documentary cinema, an upcoming event here, of course, Vanishing Points, Contemporary Writing from El Salvador, the 1st of June. We'll be plugging that a bit more later. Anthony Rudolph, nice postcard of his European Hours from Carcanet. But also, one hand clapping. I'm glad that all of you used both hands just now. Please do remember to use both at the end of the evening. But this is a magazine called One Hand Clapping, which features such interesting writers as Les Murray, Mark Doty, Al Alvarez, and Coim Tobin. So that's in the toilet, and that's before you even hit the shelves. So do keep an eye out on all parts of the building and all the various wall areas. Major event action over there, of course. Wine at the back, so do stay afterwards for another drink, and obviously for the major signing operation that we have underway here with our wonderful guests, the multi-award-winning John Burnside, of course, who needs no introduction across poetry, essays, and fiction. He's carved out this unique, singular space of major engaged inquiry into the world we live in, and a better world that might come out of our more engaged response to it, shall we say. And we're delighted, given the large historical thematic concern of the book that we're about to talk about, that Matthew Beaumont, Professor of English at UCL, is with us, a key utopian stalwart, of course, in keeping that idea alive over several key books, and also his own Night Walking Across the City, recently published by Verso. It's itself a kind of utopian act, of course, stepping out into the darkness, bringing back shards of light from that space that has been so long forbidden for so many people. So we're delighted that both John and Matthew, of course, are with us tonight, and you as well, because utopia is a collective activity. You can, I suppose, have a private utopia, but it wouldn't necessarily be called that. It probably shouldn't be called that. It might be called a dangerous obsession, I guess, if it takes too much root in your bedroom or other shed-like choice of abode. We're delighted this is a collective endeavour we're discussing tonight in the space of Havergay, which is John's response to this 500-year-old theme. I should declare an interest, a partisan interest. I was involved in the Utopia Year last year at Somerset House, Utopia 2016, as was Matthew, and was a part of the approach to John to write this book, to think out loud for us about what his utopia or his response to the theme might be. And we're delighted now to be holding it. Thanks to Little Toller Books, of course, a great favourite here at the London Review Bookshop. This is their new monograph series of contemporary writing about responses to the natural world in the broadest possible sense, ecological writing rather than environmental writing, I think. So, John, delighted to welcome you here now. And I wonder if you could just set the scene for us as to how, once this invitation came, you took us towards Havergay, because clearly the themes in the book and your response to the invitation have been working through you and through your writing for many years, I think, in different ways.
Yeah, well, I did that. I was asked to write this book last year, which made sense because it was the anniversary of Thomas More, etc. And I did actually write it last year. I want to make that clear. And I don't want to get a reputation for delivering a book a year late or anything like that. But for various reasons, it has slipped into now. It's always nice to have the last word. I mean, everybody talks about utopia last year. But, I know, because when I heard the word utopia mentioned, I thought, well, okay, this is a fiction. I didn't want to write a novel because the space was too small. But I thought it'd be quite fun to do a kind of half of a novel, as it were, to lay out a whole bunch of clues as to what a full novel might be if you were to build up the other half of it, as it were. But also, let's be frank, I just wanted to throw in a big bucket on my ideas about anarchism. And I thought that was a good excuse to do that. I had been planning to write, and I still am planning to write a book called How to Be an Anarchist. So far, no, my agent's not shown much interest. And very few publishers have as well. But I will do it one of these days. And so far, I've only managed to slip it in as a subtitle for my book on Henry Miller, which is coming out next year, plug, from Princeton University Press. I want to talk about anarchism. I've been talking a lot about the ideas of anarchism with my very good friend, Karen Ross, who's currently in New York, is coming over here quite soon again. And Karen wrote a great book called The Leaderless Revolution a few years ago, which was one of the finest books I've read for a long time, talking about how, you know, really how we need to get ourselves together and start getting rid of our leaders and actually acting for ourselves, and the principles of true anarchism. And of course, when you start talking about anarchism, people think, oh, this guy wants to throw bombs into the emperor's carriage or something, or blow something up. Unless real anarchists are actually peaceful, because we believe that one of the principles of anarchism is to follow the way that nature shows us, you know, that not to force anything, not to go against the natural flow of things, and therefore to do that is to do violence, is to do that, so it's counterproductive. So we don't actually believe in violence. That doesn't mean you're necessarily pacifist. And one of the things I wanted to deal with in the book is these characters who've come together on Havergay, they've made a kind of utopian world. What would their position be with regard to defending that world? Because we have this question of territory wherever human beings gather together, you know. I think Jesus said it, wherever two or three are gathered together, you're going to start fighting about who owns what. And you know, I wanted this community to thought that through and realize that their duty was to protect the land. And therefore, they would fight, if necessary, against people who wanted to destroy or damage or degrade the land. And that's the only justification I can think of for battle, as it were. But that's not violence. You know, reactive, protective engagement in battle isn't violence. The violence is being done, from outside as the aggressor. So that was one of the main questions. If you're going to have a utopia, what happens if you establish utopia? The obvious thing that you start thinking about then is somebody else wants to come along and take it away from you. Whether you respond to that by saying, okay, take it away, I'd rather do that than be violent, is one possibility. But if it's to do with the land itself and degradation of the land, what we've done, then you would fight to protect it. So that's one of the main questions for me. And the question of this idea of, Karen wants to call himself, I think the last thing he wanted to say was gentle anarchist. But I don't think we should say that. I think we should say we're anarchists, and anarchist means peace. Mm-hmm. It's all about peace. It's got nothing to do with throwing bombs into the, you know. They were the worst anarchists. They were also very inefficient. Usually they didn't kill the guy, they usually killed the wrong person. And one anarchist, so-called anarchist, is famous for, he tried to kill some minister, he threw the bomb in the wrong carriage or something, he got arrested anyway, and then they tried to hang him, and the rope broke. And he said, there's nothing ever go right for me. You know? And I wanted the anarchists to share that image, that we were all a bunch of inept, bomb-throwing idiots with long hair. But I actually grew my hair long recently, that's another story.
So in terms of your setting, of Havergay on a Scottish island, was that always going to? It was always going to be an island. Was it always going to be in your part of the world? Was that an inevitable outcome of the invitation?
It's not actually in my part of the world. It's on the west coast of Scotland. Right. I don't deal with west people.
Stick with the east.
I'm from the east.
In the larger geography, yeah. Then perhaps.
I mean, occasionally I speak to a Glaswegian if they're very polite. But in general, we avoid talking to Westerners, you know. No, Havergay had to be an island first.
Yeah.
And I wanted to call it something non-Scottish. And so Havergay is a corruption of the Icelandic word for nowhere. I mean, it obviously has to be called nowhere, right? But you couldn't call it utopia, and you couldn't call it various other things that have been used, nowhere, backwards, you know, etc. So I thought, well, Icelandic. And Havergay is a corruption of that Icelandic word. And it comes out really beautiful. It's a nice place. And I think one of the first things that people were talking about in the book said, it was billed as I would take the reader on a trip to Havergay as if it was a real place, you know, with its own flora and fauna and stuff. And I thought that'd be a nice follow-up book, you know, with this, you know, here's the rare Havergay tern, etc. Only eats maggots.
Exactly.
But it had to be somewhere out. I had the landscape I knew quite well.
Yep.
And I guess Scottish Island landscapes are the ones I know best.
Should we hear a little bit from it? Is that
okay? Well, I wanted to maybe read this bit about dystopia, because that was the original brief, in a sense, was to talk about the idea of utopia, or at least to think about the idea of utopia and write something coming out of that. Now, this is the idea of the book was not to have one voice dominate it, and this is several voices. And I didn't want to make them all likable. What I really hate these days is people say to me, my students, for example, say to me, I give them a book to read and say, what did you think? And they say, I didn't like it. You didn't? Anna Karenina, you didn't like it? And no, I didn't like any of the characters. They weren't sympathetic. And I think, what? You know, you don't read a book because the characters are sympathetic. So the main speaker of the whole book, actually, who puts forward all of the things that I most agree with, it's actually a bit of a bore. I mean, it's kind of somewhat tedious. He kind of goes on a bit about all of the stuff that he's learned. But this is Chloe, who, she's disappeared now. We don't know what happened to her. She probably died in one of the great disease plagues that happened. But this is her trying to write about her home village, which her father basically owns. He's from this aristocratic family. I don't know if you know that Scotland is the second most feudal country in Europe. So it's owned by about 200 families. And When you start thinning it down, it's actually a large part is owned by, you know, about 10 people or something. Mm-hmm. So Havergay is a kind of ironic result of the collapse of this aristocratic family, leaving this space for the people who actually know how to look after it to take over and actually look after it. So this is Chloe. Remember, she's only 16. She's very naive and idealistic. Havergay Village. If it is not driven by development, that is by money, a village emerges in response to the physical surroundings and the weather, of course. At one time, Havergay was such a village, but it has to be said that the reign of the Follansbees, that's the aristocrats, compromised that spontaneous process. Luckily, not as much as Brother Hugh intended, for which I thank the spirits of this place. And London, of course, where the pickings are easy and far from slim, or easy, at least for men of Brother Hugh's caliber. We also thank the earth spirits for Thomas Edison's Follansbee's father, Ashworth Follansbee, crafty old bugger that he was. Somehow he foresaw Hugh's coming and arranged things so that any heir, no matter how obnoxious, would have to respect the essential virtues of Havergay Village. Cottages would be to be maintained to a high standard and rents fixed. Hugh managed to get round some of that with his merry band of quick brown lawyers. There would always be a well-stocked library with librarian on the island. The harbour would only be used for fishing boats below a certain size. There'd be no ferry port. Anyone who wanted to get to the mainland we'd have to negotiate with the pilot of the mail boat, which came in twice a week on Mondays and Thursdays. At every turn, he closed off every scheme someone like Hugh might come up with, some of them not even anticipated by most folk back then. In my mind's eye, I see him walking around the harbour and out across the meadows, stopping to talk to one of his tenant farmers, He had no factor, which is rare. You know what a factor is? In Scotland, the factor's the most hated man in the community. He's the kind of dog, you know, his master's voice dog for the boss. He had no factor, which was rare in those days, when every estate was overseen by just such a person, loathed by all, though high in his own estimation. Then rambling out to the farthest corners of the island, looking for ways in which the greedy and the small-minded might try to turn the good land to a quick profit. The one thing he didn't anticipate was the wind turbine, but I shall talk of that later. However, as the old novelist used to say, I digress. I was discussing my distaste for the word dystopian, though to express this both fully and succinctly, the first I might attempt alone, the second I feel altogether unfurnished to tackle, as this wordy aside perfectly demonstrates, I could do no better than call upon the father of the English novel himself, Samuel Richardson, who in Clarissa, or The History of a Young Lady, declares that hope is the cordial that keeps life from stagnating. This is not to say that diagnostic analysis of social conditions and problems should not inform a novel. Indeed, the best utopian novels propose, at the very least, an implicit critique of their author's social milieu, laws, and customs. Another digression, though hopefully more pertinent. The first time the word dystopian goes down in recorded usage is when J.S. Mill invokes it in March 1868 to speak not of a fictional situation, but of catastrophic real-life conditions caused by the British government's policies in Ireland. In a long and spirited speech, he derides the Conservative government of the day thus: I may be permitted, as one who, in common with many of my betters, has been subjected to the charge of being utopian, to congratulate the government in having joined that goodly company. It is perhaps too complimentary to call them utopians. They ought rather to be called dystopians or cacotopians. What is commonly called utopian is something too good to be practicable, but what they appear to favor is too bad to be practicable. That's the Conservative government of the day. Nothing like the Conservative government we have now.
Thank you very much, John. Well, let's hold that thought about the dialogue with dystopia. And Matthew, perhaps you could think out loud for us about where John's take on this perennial theme sits in the canon, because it's a very self-aware take on this theme, isn't it? It's as you were saying to us earlier, it wears its awareness very lightly, but it's deeply engaged with this form of literature as this proposal, and doesn't hide away from the fact that it's, or doesn't try and propose that it's the first one, or it's in isolation.
Yeah, no, I think is this working, incidentally? I don't have a lot of faith in my microphone, but I'll plow on. I think self-aware is right. It's extremely aware of the tradition from which it comes, but is never self-conscious about that inheritance, that legacy. It's immensely literate, but as you say, it wears that literacy, that awareness of the utopian tradition very lightly indeed. And, you know, as you'd expect with a book from John, it's incredibly, you know, subtle, and that is not something you can say about many utopian novels, you know, going back over centuries, perhaps including Moore's book, you know, founding gesture of the genre. It's wonderfully kind of tender and melancholic in tone as well as hopeful. It really is a terrific book. The kinds of authors I think that it channels in various ways, and John might correct me or might argue that it does so unconsciously, sometimes explicit, are not just Moore, obviously, Shakespeare's Tempest, for example. There's a fairly explicit allusion to that. The kind of late 19th century utopians who regenerated the genre. Wells, who's cited in an epigraph about the future of humanity, I think it comes from the outline of history, the future of humanity being a race between education and catastrophe. that's one of the many signals that John, incidentally, is engaging in an extremely timely way with our present political conjuncture. There are references, satirical references to Trump and to other, all too contemporary phenomena, which reinforce that. Then there's William Morris as well, who imparts a kind of pastoral impetus to the book. There's Richard Jefferies, less explicitly, but I suspect that he's there somewhere, particularly in this idea, which is important, it seems, to John, of, as it were, rewilding, of allowing nature to reclaim the social and to reinvigorate it and to disorder it, but in a productive and creative way. Perhaps we can come back to that, and that is, that's an aspect of the anarchist dimension of the or premise of the utopia of the book, it seems to me. But what John does, I think, absolutely brilliantly, what he very cleverly pulls off, is that, well, really, it's just a kind of it's a kind of preface to utopia in some respects. It's a prolegomena to utopia in that, one of the problems with the utopian genre, one of the reasons that so many utopias are in many ways unreadable, is that the setting out, more or less rationally, of the organizational features of the society that's being idealized and projected and recommended to the readers tends to be an extremely dull business. It tends to be often a dry exercise in sociology. It often, involves the author riding various hobby horses extremely hard and boring the reader as a result. The whole business of actually representing utopia is often, in this tradition, I think, pathetic. It's often a complete anticlimax. And what John very brilliantly does is he just teases the reader. To give you a sense of how this plays out, his protagonist, his time traveler, who's launched sort of 50 years into the future, and it's very funny, the time traveling episode, incidentally. He arrives and is immediately put into quarantine on this island, and that's a terrific device, because it means that we never actually encounter in all its banality the world of utopia itself. Instead, we get this, we're just permanently perched on the brink of utopia, and various fascinating glimpses of utopia come our way and come the protagonist's way. They're visible through the window, as it were. And that makes it all the more alluring, all the more suggestive, all the more politically sort of tantalizing, and all the more powerful, I think. But it certainly doesn't pull its political punches as a result. One of the ways in which utopia gets glimpsed from this quarantine is in the form of various written documents that are passed on, that the protagonist gets to explore in an archival form in the building in which he's lodged, as he assimilates himself to this new world, to this new temporality, to this new space. And so we get glimpses of the kind of world that this utopia embodies and the kind of history that brought it into being through letters, through fragmentary diaries, through bits of autobiography, through writings like the one that we've just heard from John, all authored by different characters. That too, it seems to me, is a brilliant device, because, well, there's famous within utopian studies is a famous book by someone called Robert Elliott, published I think in 1970, called The Shape of Utopia, and he there makes this interesting argument that the best way of judging the newness, the radicalness, the originality, the efficacy of a utopian novel is by looking at the role that art the form that art assumes in this new society, in this utopian, this future society. It's an idea that Frederick Jameson, who was a colleague of Robert Elliott's, has historically been very taken by and has referred to many times in his writings on utopia. But of course, that presents a real representational problem as well. You know, how do you represent what a work of art would look like in an almost unimaginable future? Again, in representing that work of art or giving a sense of it, one immediately risks banalizing or pedestrianizing the new aesthetic that emerges under these new utopian social conditions. What we get instead is not a whole work of art in its utopian form. We just get these stray, these fugitive, fragmentary glimpses of writings from our future. And so I think there are various ways, in other words, in which it very cleverly and subtly circumvents some of the aesthetic and the representational problems that are pretty much structural to utopia as a genre. And that's one of the reasons why I valued it in reading it an enormous amount. I just want to, before I stop talking, I want to just quote from one paragraph, which I think is particularly revealing and suggestive. It's the conversation between our time-traveling protagonist and Ben, who's his main interlocutor, who's the individual who welcomes him to the island, and who helps to assimilate him. And it is all about assimilation in some ways. He says at one point, this place, and you'll hear an echo here of the tempest, as the play says, the island is full of voices. It's a large island. Sometimes it's hard to remember that it's an island at all. I suppose it could be argued that any utopia would have to be an island, but this canton of the imagination is even larger now than it once was, larger and more populous of voices and spirits. The image, concept of the canton of the imagination, I think is absolutely brilliant. Partly because this is a novel, as the utopian genre is more generally, obsessed with space as well as time, with carving out space of one kind or another in which some alternative might be made to seem viable or possible. And partly because of the lovely resonance of that phrase, canton, meaning which carries echoes of the poetic form canton, the song. It's a song of the imagination, this novel, as well as a corner of the imagination, a kind of a canton in that sense, a sort of geometrical segment. But encouraged, not least, in fact, by a reference slightly later on in the book to etymology, John reconstructs the etymology of hogmanay very informatively for me. Encouraged by that recourse to etymology, I went further into the etymology of canton. And it originally, perhaps someone will correct me in fact, but originally it seems it comes from heraldic grammar and refers to a corner of a crest, of a heraldic crest. Mm-hmm. But it implies something that's at a slight angle. Canton is not just a corner, but it's an angle. And I think this utopia, Havergay, very brilliantly dramatizes the way in which all utopias are at an angle. They construct a kind of canton, a sequestered, quarantined, if you like, space in which political and social and all sorts of other ideas, aesthetic ideas, might be explored that is at an odd, orthogonal angle to reality. And if, you know, If there'd been nothing else of value in the novel, and there's an enormous amount because it's hugely rich, I'd have kind of happily read it just to read that that phrase, canton of the imagination, which I think is wonderfully telling.
Well, tremendous. I'm almost tempted to say our work here is done. I mean, that was that was absolutely fantastic, Matthew. Thank you so much. John, would you like to pick up on anything that Matthew said before
I dive in? While you were talking, I was thinking about one of the things you learn when you do research is how not to do something. I may not learn how to do it, but you may at least learned how not to do it. And I don't know if you know Skinner's Walden too, I'm sure you do, where he can't help himself. He has to show you living examples as proof of everything that his utopia works. This is Skinner, the behaviorist psychologist. Yeah. He wrote this utopian book called Walden 2. And when you talk about culture, you can walk through the rooms of this Walden 2 and point to these families of people who all play the cello or something brilliantly, although 2 days ago they didn't, that kind of thing. And you know, it's very grating. I mean, I kind of agree with him in almost everything until the end. That's how my utopia would be. That would manifest itself through human relations and culture. But he's just so insistent on showing you little tableau or what are those things called in museums in America where they have dioramas. Dioramas. There's a diorama for everything. So he says something conceptual and then he points them, and there they all are. It's like something else, some grotesque movie, you know.
But I think that point you identify so well about the moment, dwelling on the threshold of the utopia is obviously a very conscious choice. And it's highlighted, understandably, on the back of the book, where you say, all I can tell you about utopia, this is a quote from one of the texts, is how to prepare for it. After that, the question of whether it has truly come into existence can only be answered by its inhabitants. So the proposal, that I think you say in the book, you're two steps away from utopia. And the offer, the idea, the kind of gift, the extension of the hand towards it, is where the real energy lies.
And he doesn't see, my time traveler doesn't see anything of utopia, and except through the telling. He does see it through the window. He sees a landscape in which you can see that something good is happening because wild animals are moving about, for example. But his only vision through to utopia is through this guy. Who is this? He's like a convert. He's so enthusiastic for all the ideas of that he's learned from the texts, that he's learned from living in this place, and it would be like, you know, joining some kind of church and having your mentor attributed to you, you know, given to you, and finding incredibly kind of effusive and you know, kind of constantly saying, oh, but you know, this is so great because this, you know, and you're like, oh, shut up. You know, but you never get to see, you have to go through and see. And then the end, and a woman arrives, thank God, because it's been all male so far, and her name is Angharad, and she, of course, you see her as evidence of the kind of calm and, well, the right word is, you know, living in accord with things, that living in utopia. And she's one of the old, because the people who came to Harrogate came in dribs and drabs from all over, desperate to get away from whatever had been behind them in their history. So, you know, they're not, they formed this community by working together. They didn't come as a community to Harvard. They made it there.
One of the ideas that the concepts that you play around with and it seems to have an important role is interanimation.
So
I wanted to ask you about that, in fact. You say, I can't remember exactly what you say, but you say as someone, you know, the phrase interanimation, as someone famous once said or something like that. And so, of course, I didn't know who had said used the phrase interanimation, and I scurried to my computer and Googled it, of course. So John Donne used it. I don't know if that's who you were thinking of, which
partly
seemed appropriate, not least given the, you know, no man is an island line. But I wondered if you, I wondered if you could say a little bit about interanimation. Not least, I was thinking back to reading A Lie About My Father and to the LSD trips that you described there, because some of what you were saying about interanimation seemed to come out of that kind of experience.
Well, I hesitate to do this because it's part of the fun. You know, when you're working on any project that's going to take more than, you know, as Norman McCaig used to say, there are three kinds of poems. There's a one cigarette poem, a two cigarette poem, and maybe even a three cigarette poem. If you're working on more than something, well, I don't smoke, but if you're working on something that involves more than three cigarettes, or in my case, probably three huge painkillers. You know, you need to amuse yourself somehow. So actually, it's a bit of a joke because somebody famous once said it's actually me.
Ah.
So I wrote a poem called Interanimation as part of a sequence that I'd done. For me, the word Interanimation as such, well, you've got the Dunn reference, but it's mostly used in terms of texts, the way in which texts interanimate each other, you know. And the theory that's expressed by the master, as it were, behind the scenes, is that, you know, we all, I mean, it's common knowledge in a sense, although we don't act as if it were, is that we all interanimate each other. You know, that creatureliness is a fabric. It's not a bunch of individual points. It's a fabric, whether we like it or not. We're all, as it were, you know, part of one living creaturely fabric. And that's what an environment, that's what an ecology is, yeah. I mean, it's quite fun. So at the height of when everybody, so I guess it was the 80s, all the old hippies were saying things like, yeah, we're all one man, you know, we're all, and Baudrillard came out and said, yeah, we are, unfortunately, you know. Because it isn't just an easy thing to say, oh, we're all kind of, we all depend on each other and we all are part of this interplay of creatureliness. It's also a huge responsibility and a matter sometimes of pain. The disease which causes the possibility for the utopia to happen on the island, the disease is caused by all of the things that are actually causing diseases. Hugely advanced kind of ways in which we can move disease vectors around the world. You know, somebody gets on a plane in Sydney and goes to New York and, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, the fact of interanimation, the fact that we're all part of this creaturely fabric means that things like diseases can spread really quickly or could under certain circumstances. I don't know if everybody read that book, Randy Schultz's book about the AIDS crisis and the band Played On. And he's got this wonderful passage, this wonderful tragedy, it makes you weep, about how everything started from what they called, you know, patient zero or patient one or whatever it was, and worked out how, and it happened, this guy was a flight attendant for Air Canada, I think it was. And so he was traveling all around the world and you know, he was very promiscuous apparently, and he was having lots of relationships around the world, and he was really spreading this virus around. But he didn't know. And when they found him, they said to him, he kind of understood what they were saying to him, that he was number one guy, this huge pattern. And he said, no, I can't be number one. If I had it, someone gave it to me. You know, but that horrible moment of responsibility, you know, when you go to work, you shouldn't go to work. You should stay in bed. You got a cold. You go to work, and then 5 days later, everybody's got the cold that you had. You think, oh, that was me. That was my fault. You know, and that's part of being interanimate as well. You know, it's a kind of banal part of it, perhaps. But, you know, that fabric of being is still dark and light and rich and banal and all of these things. That's what I thought by interanimation. The poem is actually about me and a cow. I was trying to save this cow who was dying of milk fever, and she fell on me. And I just remember having that feeling when I realized my pelvis wasn't broken, that, you know, she and I were in it together. You know, so, and that's where the idea of that internet animation came out of. So it was a little joke with myself, you know. I do have an ego, after all.
Thank you. Well, just before we open it out, thoughts for both of you, really, in slightly different ways, but can we come back to this idea of the natural order? Because the anarchist impulse through the book is absolutely central, as you've said so well already, and the idea that anarchism is not chaos, but actually a respect for a much deeper and larger order. But that relates to what Matthew picked out about rewilding and the idea that again, this imposition of an artificial and temporary human order removes incredible ranges of possibility from the world that both humans and other species share. So I just wonder, Matthew, a question for you about anarchist utopias. Is there a tradition, a particular tradition of that? And then, John, I suppose just thinking out loud about what the implications of that mean, really, for both the reader and obviously onwards into the world.
I mean, the tradition of anarchist utopias is much less pronounced, as far as I know, than socialist utopias, and indeed the socialist utopian tradition is tends to be at the more authoritarian end of the socialist spectrum anyway. I mean, utopian thinking, to the extent that it is, and utopian fiction, to the extent that it is about programmatically laying out an ideal future, often involves a kind of a top-down control. It involves a state that's central to everything, and so it's much less rich in the utopian tradition in utopias that explore anarchism as a political possibility. I mean, in many ways, I think the utopian tradition would have been a lot richer for that, and it would have been less different in some ways to realist fiction if it had, because it would necessarily be about the individual relationships that go up to make go together to make a good community, the interanimation, to use your term, and less about the kind of social strictures and the rational plans that might coordinate people in the mass. Mm. So to that extent too, I think this is a really original contribution to the genre. I mean, off the top of my head, I can't think of any anarchist fictions. There are anarchist fiction. No doubt, someone in the audience will be able to point to ones that I've forgotten off the top of my head. But that's my instinct. Mm-hmm. Is that. I don't know what you think, John.
I think William Morris comes as close as anybody to what I would think of in that way. I thought you were asking.
Well, I mean, there's just this idea about order. The natural order. Which I think is really, I mean, it's a fundamental dialogue with anarchism, isn't it? From, the worst, media soundbites of this bringing of chaos.
It's extraordinary, even now, that... people report in the news and they'll say, it's anarchy here. Mm. And no, it's not. Anarchy means that every individual votes for what they want to happen and the community negotiates that, etc. But historically, every kind of philosophical writer I've ever found interesting turns out really to be an anarchist. I mean, Lao Tzu in the Tao Te Ching, this is Tao Te Ching, yeah. he's putting down the principles of following the natural order. You observe the natural order. He says the Tao that you can speak about isn't the real Tao, and you don't know what that is. It's a mystery. So it's like maybe like some kind of Christian God, say. But you can see the action of the Tao everywhere you look in nature. And if you look at the action of the Tao in nature and follow it, then you won't make mistakes. So if there's nothing wrong with human order or human design, as long as it is observant of the natural order. But if it tries to control nature, if it tries to impose itself on nature, including other people, which are part of nature too, then it goes wrong. It's bound to go wrong. But the other one in the Western tradition is Spinoza. Spinoza's in the Ethics, it seems to be a wonderful, he lays out in a very beautiful, elegant way, the idea of following the natural order. So it isn't just some kind of Eastern thing. It was there in the Western tradition all the time. And many others I can think of in terms of philosophy. And even, I remember when I was a student, I was very interested in Heidegger, and my German philosophy teacher said, where's the books on Heidegger in the library? He said, what, that Nazi? And he was. I'm afraid, sad, he was a Nazi. Yeah, okay. But he also wrote some of the most interesting things about our problems with technology and with building, etc., which we all know now is very valuable text. And one of those, a little essay, Building, Dwelling, Thinking, as was probably most people are aware of it, still for me says a lot about the human relationship with the natural world in terms of what we do when we build. I mean, when we build anything, and dwelling as well. And dwelling, of course, has now become a kind of cliche of kind of eco-critical thinking of, this is the way we distinguish between imposing our order on the world around us and living in accord with the world around us, and we call that dwelling. If we can manage to do that, and make people like some bioregionalists say, I'm dwelling in the natural world, in my region, according to the ecology of the region, according to the order that's there. Everything that I've ever found elegant in building, in architecture, these things, they all seem to me to derive their most beautiful and elegant features from looking at the natural world. So I wanted to just, I mean, there are many more left out, but I wanted to just have in that book just little snippets here and there of things from Spinoza, something from Lao Tzu, something from Zhang Tzu, and, you know, say, this is a worldwide vision. You know, it isn't just some people over here. All over the world, at different times, in different cultures, in different philosophical trends, anarchist thinkers have emerged. They didn't necessarily call themselves anarchists. But if you think about the etymology of the word anarchy, it's relatively self-explanatory. Instead of having a top-down order imposed upon things, we allow order to emerge. And it chimes with emergence theory in science. It chimes with, you know, all kinds of things. Chaos theory, too. We tend to, I've been doing a lot of work on bees for about 10 years now, 7 years certainly, with Amy Shelton, an artist down in, who lives down in Exeter and does wonderful work with bees. And one of the things you learn from looking at bees is they're not little hives of industry like some 16th century moral story will say, or, you know, that bees aren't there to serve us. And all of these ways which we use bees in a kind of, you know, kind of symbolic way, I suppose, or metaphorical ideas about bees, Mandeville's ideas of all the, you know, the hive is this kind of utopian, actually, vision. Mm. And everybody's got their job to do, and they all do it, and they're all efficient, and stuff like that. Or Maeterlinck's idea about how you can constantly take away the honey, and yet they still continue to function. Well, actually, as we now know from colony collapse disorder problems, you keep on taking away the honey and replacing it with corn syrup, your bees are going to die, yeah? But if you just let them live according to the order that they create in the hive or in the, you know, whatever, they continue to prosper. But the first thing we did wrong about bees was to say, to call this bee here the queen. Take it to a human being, take it any woman in this room. Would you like to be the queen if the queen means you sit immobile all the time, force-fed this gooey royal jelly stuff, and pump out babies all the time? Does that sound like queenship to anybody here? How do anybody could mistake that condition for a queen? I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's a brilliant example of how, yeah, the human order is imposed on the natural to great detriment all round.
Can I just say very quickly, Ursula Le Guin, preemptively to say that, she's the author of Anarchist Utopias. And
absolutely.
But yeah. Morris, I think Morris is important. Yeah. Morris is clearly important to you because, apart from anything, and I won't say anything more about this, but maybe we can discuss this further in the, later, is that the aesthetic, the artwork is a model for the kind of society you imagine. Yeah. Play, that you know, the society that you imagine is one in which things are done as an end in themselves and to which play is absolutely structural. Mm. Anyway.
No, tremendous, exactly. And I hope it's clear before we open out that, of course, because John doesn't dwell on who's doing the washing up or cleaning the toilets, he has much more space to think out loud about these spiritual, philosophical concerns. And the book is full of these extended reflections on the nature and role of breath and play, as Matthew said, in ways that are absolutely rigorous and free of all the waffle that we might find elsewhere. So, yeah, tremendous work. Any thoughts? Your own utopia, of course. Do propose them very briefly, if you can. Any responses to what you've heard, provocations, challenges, dystopian inquiries, or anything else along those lines, which pretty much covers all of human life.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key.
everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently, so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Yes, thank you.
John, I just wanted to ask you about... Is this actually on?
I can hear you.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the role in your book of the inarticulate and the inarticulable and the relationship to that to the idea of a utopian project. So it seems that there's something... Well, you're sketching out something that seems like kind of the diametric opposite of the liberal Habermasian idea of a community of rational agreement on ideas. You're talking about something, somehow people coming to an understanding about working on living together on grounds that can't be set out necessarily in explicit ideas or with words. And so I just wanted to ask you to comment about this idea of a community of people living together on a basis that's not explicit and based on rational principles.
Yeah, right. I guess one of the ways I'd respond to that is talk about barn building. A lot of communities are one of the things that people do in the community, and it's kind of built in as an assumption here and an implication here that they would do the same thing, is that when somebody needs a home, everyone around builds it with them. And they don't have to, you know, they didn't draw up designs or anything. They build it together, and they would know, you know. And of course, I love this. It's a film. It's really bad. Every other way possible, it's bad. But there's one scene in it where it's called, it's got Harrison Ford.
Witness.
Yeah, and they do a barn building scene. And you see this Peter Weir was a very talented guy. He just couldn't handle narrative. But this barn building scene is gorgeous, and they all come together, and you see people who've got their little kind of grudges and things, but when they get together and build the barn, they just silently build it together, well, more or less silently. They occasionally say, you want, there has to be some nails, or do you want a sandwich? But you know, that's about it. And they build it together, and they know how to build it together. And I think you learn how to live in community, not because of principles. I don't think you learn how to live in community that way. You wouldn't. It would have to be kind of more spontaneous than that. But that I was actually talking yesterday about the three part agreement, kind of Habermas's three part agreement idea, in the context of something completely different in a way. But it was interesting because what I felt I've seen recently is ever since Tony Blair's Princess Diana speech, and then on into why we were in Iraq, Tony Blair had jettisoned the first part of that Habermas is talking about, you know, the facts, the truth, the observable facts around us, and then we can come to an agreement on those. He just jettisoned those. But said, we could all agree, because I agree, that morally and socially and communally, this is good. And then, I very sincerely believe this, so we're going to go and do this. So, He basically said, two and three still hold for me, you know, the social and the effective, as it were, the individual. And now we've got Donald Trump, who's completely said, you know, said, forget facts, or Fox News, forget facts, forget any kind of social or communal agreement about what might be moral or not. Just, this is the answer. I hold these things to be true, sincerely, I hold them to be true. And therefore, my facts are true because they're mine. Yours are irrelevant because I know that yours are wrong and I know mine are right. And that's what the basis of public discourse is at the moment in politics. It's something happened in France during the election, and it's happening here now during our election. people said to me, there's this really silly thing that's going around saying that Jeremy Corbyn hasn't been fairly treated by the press. Isn't that silly? The press are all left wing. I was looking at his press like, have you got two heads or what? You know, every time I see Channel 4 News, as soon as anybody who's got any sympathy whatsoever with Labour in any way whatsoever, they immediately shove the microphone in their face and say, but do you think Corbyn's electable? Can he win? You know, and you think, oh, actually, let's talk about the policies. Do these policies make sense or do these policies make sense? We've skipped that altogether. We've done it for a long time now, but we haven't even, we're now agreeing that it should all be about how we feel about this guy or that guy or Theresa May's shoes, you know? She has got better shoes than Jeremy Corbyn. I'm going to vote for her. But you know, that kind of sense of that. And of course, an anarchist community would exist by constantly working things out, you know? The way that an ice hockey team plays, you know? You don't just stand in your position and wait for the puck to come to you. You flow following the puck or following the defense plan that you've got, whatever it might be. You constantly flow. I mean, we learn from things like that. I mean, ice hockey is a natural activity, remember? It's not a human activity.
I was going to say, ice hockey versus the natural order.
No, they're the same. When people play well, ice hockey expresses a natural order. That's the thing. That's what sport is for. I mean, we didn't mention sport, but I assume that culture also means sport. And, you know, if you see a great baseball team playing or a great ice hockey team playing, they are expressing natural order and not some kind of human order. Some coach might sit them down in a room beforehand and say, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, this and this. And here's a diagram. But once they get on the ice, it's something else is happening. And the ones who don't play well are the ones who try to do what the coach told them. Coaches are only good for one thing. Making pep talks during speeches. But you shouldn't plan anything, you should just let the team play.
Could you just use the thank you?
I was just gonna wait for us to say that the same applies to music, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Okay. Oh, is it gone? Is it? Is it
done?
All right. No, I agree completely, yeah. And I think I cut it out in the end. There was gonna be a section about improvisation. Because I like jazz, and often people I meet who say, "Oh, I don't understand jazz, or I don't like jazz, or whatever." They think that when I talk about improvisation, they mean these bunch of guys just walk into a room, sit down, and then all start playing together magically, you know, in this wonderful, which can happen. But I try to explain, and my son is interested in music. But so far, it's playing Kurt Cobain songs really, really violently on his guitar. I tried to rearrange them for ukulele, which is kind of insane. But I try to explain to him about, you know, what the standard is, that you use a standard. And the more banal the standard, the more inventive. You know, Miles Davis doing Someday My Prince Will Come. I mean, you know, a very banal song. Or Cyndi Lauper's song, Time After Time. You hear Miles' version of that in Munich, the live concert in Munich. It's beautiful, it makes you weep. It's so brilliantly inventive and emotionally kind of devastating. And you think, that was based on that little pop song, Time After Time, you know, that song. And, you know, and the whole band working together. And yeah, okay, Davis might have given them some thoughts to start off with, but then somebody steps out and blows, you know, their own thing, you know. Yeah, it's magical, but it's real. It isn't magical at all. Something happens, it's spontaneity. It's Hokusai saying, somebody said to Hokusai, how do you draw bamboo? How do you paint bamboo? And he said, oh, you look at bamboo for 17 years, then you become bamboo, and then you start painting. It's easy. Isn't that what Miles Davis is? He became several forms of jazz, you know.
I wonder whether that's also, in a way, the process of writing. I don't know if you know this, Claude Simon's speech to the Nobel Committee when he won the Nobel Prize. He said a lovely thing about the process of writing. You don't start with an intention. You start by writing, and then it happens.
Yeah.
Whereby the result is always infinitely richer than the intention. And that's kind of what you're saying.
Well, absolutely, yeah, and that's another example of anarchism in action.
Yeah.
If I try to impose an intention upon my writing, I'm acting like a boss, you know? And if I let something happen, yeah. People don't know how they do things.
Hello. In Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed, obviously the language is really important to the community in Utopia, essentially. In Havergate, is the language evolved different? Did you explore that at all?
Good question. Did we hear it?
Question about language in Ursula Le Guin and whether the language in Havergate is part of the Utopian project.
Yeah. I would have liked to have done something on that, but I didn't in the end because it's actually quite a short book. It's only 50,000 words. But yeah, I mean, it's fascinating how actually language evolution is often more an interest for dystopian writers, isn't it? You often find that the dystopian writer is talks about the way in which a certain kind of language, not evolution so much as imposition, isn't it? Really, like Orwell or
Zamyatin.
Devolution
or
yeah.
Of language, or sort of reification of language, or the reduction of language to merely kind of technological or technical or utilitarian, limits.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah. I think that's true about dystopia.
Reduction is really, I think, the key thing, and it happens every day, of course. The powers that be want us to speak a reduced language. Because it reduces our ability to question subtly what they want us to buy. I mean, they're always selling us something, right? Whether it's a new iPhone or a war, they're selling us these things, and they're using language to sell it. And they want us to speak a very simple language, a reduced language, because then we can't question it so much. And people say to me, oh, you're political and yet you write poetry. Why are you wasting your time writing poetry? As Auden says, poetry makes nothing happen. And I believe that every poem is every good poem, or whatever that means, every poem that I like, does something with language, which insists upon language's richness and subtlety and importance, in the world. That as long as the poets are still writing poems and we read them, we remember that language is rich and complex. And it's trying to match a rich and complex world in its descriptions. Not just poets, of course, but, that's one of my explanations for still pointlessly writing poems, which trouble people read, is that poets insist upon the importance and complexity of language. And the powers that be don't want, they don't like poets. I mean, we're not dangerous. I mean, I'm not going to say that one, poets are dangerous, because they're free, ha, ha, ha. But, they still don't like us very much unless they can co-opt us to write kind of copy for advertising. They don't like the fact that, Joe Shapka's book about war language, for example, and all of it's about that, but the way in which we use this reduced vocabulary for war, because it covers up the gruesomeness and ugliness of war. We use euphemism all the time. And the way in which people sell us stuff. I always find it interesting that I've lived for 60 years now, and I've heard the words fresh and new describing every product that I've ever seen advertised. And I thought, well, what was it like before? Wasn't it fresh before? Or wasn't it new before? Or wasn't it, new advanced? You think, was it, how, in which way has it advanced? It's still detergent, And we just swallow all this stuff. And of course, the poet wants to say, hey, it's not new, it's not advanced, it's detergent. And so, I wish I'd made it into a twice as long a book. Maybe not, actually. I'd probably still be writing it.
More than enough to do.
Yeah, exactly. But no, language is very, very interesting in terms of talking about all of those. I don't actually believe in utopia, by the way, as such. I believe that anarchism would be a communal lifelong project in which we would constantly fail, but fail in more interesting ways than we're currently failing, which is at least something.
Can I just make a couple of quick observations? in response to that question. One is that that the title, although it doesn't devise a new language in the way that Moore's Utopia did, for example, the title gives a glimpse of that.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably the only word in the novel that does, but it, you know, nonetheless sort of opens out to the kind of linguistic experimentation and imagining that you're talking about. But the other thing I'd say is that you place a certain amount of emphasis, particularly towards the end, on the redemption of words that have become words that we use or don't really use, that have either become rusty or have become so ideologically freighted and you know, been overburdened with religious associations, become meaningless, etc. You impart a kind of new meaning to them in this new context of a different kind of society. In particular, to cite them, kindness, grace, honour. Yeah. So it is about, yeah, it's about regenerating language, if not generating a new language.
Yeah, and I think the most important of those right now is honour. You know, we have an astonishing ability to allow people to get away with the most incredible things, that if you had any honour at all, you'd be resigning or committing harakiri or something, you know. It's such a dishonorable society we live in. Well, this part of it, you know, the Anglo-American kind of, maybe to some extent European, lack of honor. But we've made honor a dirty word now, because if you use the word honor now, you start thinking about honor killings or something like that. The honor in day-to-day life. Yeah.
Except in this bookshop, where words are honoured for their original meanings, for their perfectly great singular segment. Expression, precise, rigorous, pay me later, rigorous and beautiful, of course, always freighted with the best possible intentions, expanding the horizons of the possible. So many thanks to you for coming. Thanks to everyone at the shop. John Burnside, Matthew Bond, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.